Welcome to The Independent with Scott Atlas by The Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to important issues facing our society today. Today's guest, May Mailman, director of Independent Women's Law Center. May spent 4 years as a White House legal advisor to President Donald Trump, where she advised on a wide range of policies and more recently served as the Deputy Solicitor General for the state of Ohio. I'm proud to say May is also one of the star rising leaders of the Global Liberty Institute. May is now lead counsel in Westenbrook versus Kappa Kappa Gamma, a landmark case that seeks to preserve female-only sororities. We will have a conversation about her critical work on the fight to protect women's privacy and ultimately the legal relevance of biological sex in the United States. So thanks for joining us and stay tuned. May Mailman, welcome. Great pleasure to have you here.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Let's get right into it and start with all the great work you're doing. But I want to sort of begin first with your personal history. How did you begin your interest in advocacy in general? I think you're an inspirational figure. You're doing some very important work, very high profile, and you're very young. And I want to get not just your work out there, but hopefully inspire young people to do some of the great things you're involved with. So tell me how you began. And I want to start this by saying I notice you're from Kansas, and I'm from University of Illinois. I was from Chicago, and I still resent Kansas for stealing our basketball coach, Bill Self. So I usually wouldn't even interview somebody from Kansas, but I'm going to make an exception here.
Well, we're paying him for it, so I actually would want another championship for the amount of money that we're paying. But sorry about that. So yeah, I'm from Western Kansas. I grew up on 60 acres. I went to public school. My mom is not from this country, and you know, here I am as director of the Independent Women's Law Center, fighting for the existence of the English language and for like the basic principles of Western civilization. But, you know, yes, women's rights, but it's much bigger than that. So I think that there's something really great about being a big fish, or if you're in a small town, really just a fish in a small pond, is that you get to try everything. And I think it's really good for self-esteem. I think this is one of the reasons why I like to fight for women's spaces, is finding your thing, finding mentors, finding just the freedom to try new things can be really hard in, I don't know, co-ed spaces, really big schools. But for kids who are from small towns, you really, I think, get to build up your self-esteem and try a lot of things. And I think that's part of, you know, I went to the University of Kansas. It was a lot harder than the schools I went to in rural Kansas. But You learn to figure it out. You're kind of Midwest tough, I guess. And then did Teach for America, went to Harvard for law school. Same thing. Like, you have to level up, but Clarence Thomas talks about that. There, you do. And then you've got a choice in your career. You can either go make buckets of money from a big corporate law firm, or you can do something interesting. And that choice was really made for me. I was in a law firm, not a big corporate law firm, like a litigation firm. But I got a random phone call saying, hey, do you want to work in the White House? And I said yes to that instantly. And that, I think, once you do work that's that interesting, you're not going to go back.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, as we all know, most of us who had anything to do with the Trump administration, we're not well received, let's put it that way, by half the country afterwards, even though we were working for their country. But it's not just interesting, it's also important. And I think I've sort of reflected on this myself many times, but you know, one of the things you want to do with your life is do something that's impactful and important. And it's not only, of course, through work. You and I both have children. Ours are different ages. There's challenges, but of course, in my view, that's the most important thing I ever did. But it's also nice to do things with work that are that are very important and things you feel very strongly about, which I know you do. So let's shift with that into your work on really what I will call Title IX, even though you may do other things. I want to start with you explaining what Title IX is, because Title IX is a term that's in the news. I don't think most people even know exactly what it is, and I certainly don't think most people understand that it was a landmark law signed by President Richard Nixon.
Yeah, so this is a 1972 law, you know, vigorously debated, went through multiple iterations. It was passed along the same timeline that states were considering whether to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, which would have enshrined sex in the U.S. Constitution, which ended up happening anyway, just through litigation. And it was designed so that any education program that accepts federal dollars, so people think about public universities, but this goes all the way down to daycares. I mean, any education program that accepts federal dollars cannot discriminate on the basis of sex. People see this often as athletics, and also people hear about it in the news as you forbid sexual harassment on campus. And so if somebody's accused of sexual harassment, then universities have all these Title IX procedures that they have to go through. And so Biden's Title IX regulation addresses a lot of different things. It addresses that discrimination on the basis of sex now means discrimination on the basis of gender identity. It strips away protections of people who are accused of sexual harassment on campus. And it has a lot of free speech implications as well, because it changes the definition of what sexual harassment means, so that if you say one thing that's wrong, that all of a sudden now you have a Title IX investigation against you.
So, yeah, so just to sort of summarize it for my own brain, we think of Title IX about as if it were about sports, but it's not only about sports. But its biggest impact, I think, or at least most famous impact, was the explosion of opportunities for women in college sports or sports really all up and down through the educational system. I mean, I've read some statistics on this, and there's just an explosion from what was non-existent on things like athletic scholarships for women and girls, even just the number of women participating in sports. And I think, yeah, we're not all athletes. I certainly am not an athlete. But sports is a big part of a lot of things in life, including learning, and simply the opportunity is what really that really opened up. But you know, I think it's moved into and this is what you're alluding to. What is the in June of 2022, the Biden administration proposed major changes to Title IX. It wasn't just about sports, and then in April, I think, of this year, they introduced a formal list of final, quote, regulations. So why don't you tell me about what that has done and what some of these issues are, because it's not just about sports and allowing transgender athletes or whatever to participate. There's a lot more to it.
Exactly. When it was the unofficial rule, it was 1,577 pages. So there's a lot going on in this regulation. But I'll just cover three buckets because that's what we're challenging in court. So one, Title IX, the text says that you cannot discriminate on the basis of sex. The Biden administration's rule says that that means you cannot discriminate on the basis of gender identity. That sounds kind of nice. Nobody should be discriminated against on the basis of anything. But what it actually means is that if you have to be treated alongside your internal sense of self, your gender identity, otherwise that's discriminatory, then that means you can self-identify into bathrooms, locker rooms, sports, dorms, you know, specific sex ed classes, health classes, PE classes, you know, those types of things, that women's scholarships, that it is your identity now that gives you rights rather than your sex. So that's probably the biggest bucket. The second bucket is it changes the definition of harassment, like I said, to make that no longer, it had to be severe and pervasive harassment. Now it's severe or pervasive. So anything that you say that's bad, like misgendering, is now actionable under Title IX. And then the third bucket is removing protections from people who are accused of sexual assault. Obviously, that's often males. And so already males are not going to college. And now another reason, why would you, if you can be accused of sexual assault and you no longer have various procedures to protect you, including things like access to evidence, like what is the evidence mm-hmm. against me, that these types of things.
Right. So I'm going to go sort of randomly through those three buckets, if you'll indulge me here. The third one, this idea of accusations of sexual misconduct on campuses. Is this what the Trump administration, with your involvement, I presume, changed, which was then stripped back by the Biden administration, which is that the accusation itself of sexual misconduct, rape, whatever you want to put in that bag, was enough to really to convict people without even basic rights of facing the accuser or seeing the evidence. Is that what the Trump administration introduced on behalf of people who were accused of something, that they could actually go through some general thing consistent with the rights in the United States?
Exactly. So Title IX is actually not a sexual harassment statute. Like I said, it says you can't discriminate on the basis of sex. But through the years, it's been interpreted that if you allow sexual harassment on campus, you, the university, allow that behavior to go on, you are discriminating on the basis of sex. So universities have this duty to stop sexual harassment, misconduct, assault, in order to provide equal opportunities on the basis of sex. So what the Obama administration did is they said, in order to prevent sexual harassment, the duty that you universities need to do is take away all rights of the accused. I mean, you need to give the victim, the person who says that something happened to them, all sorts of benefits and give the accused no benefits. And they did this not in a regulation, they just did it in a guidance letter that they sent out. So the Trump administration decided we're going to actually protect against sexual harassment, but we're going to do it in a regulation. And they did a few things, like they banned the single investigator model. So you can't have one person on campus who's both the judge and the jury, right? And the person mm-hmm. researching the facts. You have to at least have some separation there. We're going to give people who are accused the written complaint against them and the evidence against them. And then now Biden is basically going all the way back to Obama level protections, which the left actually was not really in favor of these Obama protections, because it used to be the case, I think, that the left actually believed in due process. And I think it's something like 600 of these cases that happened on college campuses had been challenged and had some level of success. I mean, students really were challenging their lack of due process and winning. So the Trump rules were meant to enshrine those due process protections that students were arguing for and getting when they went to court.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what's shocking, there's two things that stand out to me as, again, like I'm a layman here. But it's shocking that there's such a lack of due process, a basic due process. You can't even see the evidence if you're accused of a serious crime like that on campus, and the all the decisions are made sort of closed doors, et cetera. That's shocking to me. You know, the other thing that's shocking is this is another illustration of the power of the president, the executive authority. I didn't realize we're living in a country where the laws are just simply decreed. I mean, I always thought there was check and balance on power, that the legislature is the body that determines laws.
That's, I think, one of the more egregious things. Obviously, the policy here is pretty bad, but it is obvious that Title IX is a sex protection statute, that you can't discriminate on the basis of sex. And to just rewrite it to be gender identity, or to rewrite it to create all of these burdens on college administrators, to basically create police departments on campus, that's very expensive. That's very specific. And of course, the Trump administration did it too, right? So like they had all sorts of sexual harassment procedures in the Title IX regulation. It's sort of where we are now, where we're run by bureaucratic fiat rather than mm-hmm. by Congress. And like, who's to blame for that? I guess Congress, because Congress does not care. I mean, they just watch a bunch of bureaucrats take their jobs away and they don't care.
Right. I mean, I was always and still am stunned by what I would say, you know, unfortunately, is the impotence of Congress. I'm not sure why you would even want a job where you have zero really impact. But that's a separate topic for another conversation. I want to, before we finish with this bucket here, this category of what Title IX does with the sexual assault, sexual harassment issue, not just discrimination. When did this occur that somebody's language about your pronoun or your gender was considered sexual harassment? Where is that in its origin in the United States judicial or penal system? I don't get that.
Yeah, so this is a tough one, but Title IX is a little bit unique, I guess, in that the law can both be enforced by individuals and it can be enforced by the Department, I guess, the Department of Justice, Department of Education. So the regulation is the Department of Education doing its part to enforce Title IX. But any student right now who attends a school that accepts federal dollars can sue their school saying, I was discriminated against on the basis of my sex, and therefore I am owed money and the school stopping it. So a lot of this crazy stuff like that misgendering violates Title IX, it starts from plaintiffs saying, and the facts are always that the teacher is not trying to do anything wrong. The teacher is like very scared, and you know who's teachers these days besides
sure.
you. they're just trying to use people's last names, you know, just like, let's just get by the day. And either they'll slip up one time or the student will say, no, I do not want to be othered. I do not want to be called my last name, and I deserve to be called so-and-so. But a lot of this, I think, goes back to a 2020 decision actually written by a conservative justice, Justice Gorsuch, where there was a little bit of a conflation of what it means to treat someone badly, you know, based on their sex, and what it means to treat someone, quote unquote, badly based on their gender identity. So there is a Supreme Court angle there, but a lot of this has to do with liberal plaintiffs and liberal judges just totally reinventing Title IX, which they can do because anyone can sue under Title IX if they feel right. aggrieved against their school.
And it seems like partly this is the fear of liability is adding to the, my guess is that a lot of these cases are settled because they want to, the university or whatever wants to end the discussion. They don't want the publicity. They want to just, and so that feeds, instead of fighting these things, the incentive is probably for many of these people, particularly college administrators and university so-called leaders, which is not really a good word for them, is they just want to get out of the heat of the controversy. And so that feeds into, that rewards the lawsuit. That's just my own opinion, but I don't really sort of, I think it's so destructive in so many ways, including a lot of my friends who teach at some of these business schools and things where they're, Stanford Business School is an example. I'm friends with a lot of the people who teach there. They're walking on eggs with the students because the students sit there and record or list or file a complaint internally about any so-called transgression. And I think it's a potential lawsuit all the time. There's a long line of consequences from these kinds of lawsuits. As you know, I think it's very destructive. The other thing I want to get into this idea of discrimination, okay? Because this pertains both to the women's sports and college issue, but also this landmark case that you're lead counsel for, preserving female-only sororities. Why don't you walk us through first, like, the facts of the case? I'm not a law school professor. I'm not interrogating you, but and then I have my own questions because, you know, I went to a college, University of Illinois, where we had a lot of sororities and fraternities, and my recollection was fraternities and sororities choose their members. Number one, number two, you don't have to join a fraternity or sorority. I didn't. And number three, there are plenty of fraternities and sororities that restrict their membership on the basis of things like race. I mean, we've seen there are a lot of Black American fraternities and sororities, and that's just one example. So I don't even understand the controversy.
Yeah.
Let's start with that one.
So this is arising in the University of Wyoming, where there was a biological male who, first he went through Rush and got cut from every home. Kind of a weird guy, apparently, like it with one house, not apparently, weird. Talked about cadavers.
You're talking about he went through Rush for sororities?
For sororities.
Okay.
And didn't get a bid from any of the house. And so this is in the complaint that with one of the houses, he talked about wanting to be close to dead bodies. So things like that, I think, cut based on personality and not much beyond that. But then all of a sudden, sororities can have sort of a back door to recruitment if you don't have enough members. And you do have to have enough members in order to be financially viable as a sorority. So okay. This individual, biological male, was invited to do this continuous open recruitment. Not all of the women got to meet with him. It was a little bit rushed, and it felt as though the women in the house said it felt as though we were really being pushed to accept this guy. Like it was not the normal process. And then when the voting happened, they were told if they voted against him, that it would be a sign of bigotry, and bigotry would be a basis for expulsion from the sorority. And there were some members
who told them that voting against this person was a sign of bigotry or whatever.
So the messengers were the leadership in the Wyoming chapter. So this is going to be like the chapter president. But it's the assertion in the complaint is that she didn't make this up, that there are alumni advisors that were very involved in this process, more involved than they've ever been with an open recruitment person, and that the national sorority was really behind this, wanting Wyoming to initiate a male. I mean, they thought it would be good, I think, for the image of the chapter, maybe, or they were just personally woke, or they felt pressure, you know, what have you. Right. But that there was this coordinated effort through the alumni advisors, through nationals. And so all of a sudden, now the voting is different. Usually voting is anonymous. They now told these girls, we're going to send out a Google poll in which you have to attach your email address. So voting is not anonymous. They're going to know how every person votes. Oh, some women, we're not going to let them vote, even though the chapter bylaws say that everyone has to vote on a new member. Normally, there even aren't speeches for members in Kappa. You can maybe say something like, oh, this was the girl in the red shirt. You can say something, but they're not discussing women. But somehow they're discussing this man. So of course, the male gets through. And so these women kept asking Kappa, please, can we not have this happen? Kappa did not care about them at all. And so they decided to sue. And the suit is pretty simple, which is Kappa's bylaws say that new members shall be women. It's plain as day. And the directors of Kappa Kappa Gamma owe fiduciary duties to the organization. They can't just ignore the bylaws. And yet not only did they ignore them, they really rammed down the opposite reading on these girls in bad
faith. So this is a lawsuit of current sorority members or member suing the sorority itself for forcing admission of a genetically male person as a sorority member.
Yeah, and derivative lawsuits are a little bit weird in that they're technically these girls are suing on behalf of the sorority. They're suing the directors. So they are stepping in the shoes and saying, hey, directors, you injured me, me being the sorority itself. So the district court saw the bylaw, said, okay, we see that a new member shall be a woman. But the district court said woman could mean man. And so I'm just going to move on with my day. Like they didn't violate anything. And
so there is no problem, though, correct me if I'm wrong, with a fraternity or sorority choosing its own members on the basis of any criteria whatsoever. Or is that's not true?
So Title IX would technically probably prohibit sororities on its face from discriminating on the basis of sex, and that you'd have to have co-ed sororities. But sororities, therefore, got a specific exemption in Title IX. So sororities are written into
Title IX.
Yep, in the law, that they are allowed to basically violate the law. So in that sense, sororities are allowed to discriminate on the basis of sex. They are also allowed to discriminate on the basis of, I guess, gender identity, because there's no law prohibiting that. Although a lot of state laws have gender identity, protections. But the First Amendment protects private membership organizations, for example, like Miss Universe or one of these Miss Americas. They have a natural born female requirement and they're allowed to keep that. So private membership organizations where your members are your message. And I think for sororities, their members are their message. It is about sisterhood, like that who they are and who their members are one.
So this is not really a lawsuit against the University of Wyoming.
Uh-uh.
This is against individuals who forced the sorority, meaning the board of directors of the sorority or whoever these people are, forced the sorority to accept this member, and the people who are opposed to that in the sorority are suing.
Exactly. Yeah. And okay. Your race question is sort of interesting because in a sense, private membership organizations based on race have been a huge target because historically they have been white organizations to discriminate against other people. Now, of course, we see a lot of African-American based sororities, fraternities, and other groups. And I think that it's the First Amendment really is the argument there. So, for example, Hamilton the Musical, I think, is one that comes up in Supreme Court cases. They only hire minority cast members. They only want to hire minority cast members. And that's okay because it's their message. Their message is they need to have minority cast members. So, but once you start getting away from the First Amendment, some of those reasons start to disappear.
Mm-hmm. So let's move on to women's sports, because I think this is, again, back to the most famous or at least most well-known part of Title IX was this opportunity for women, because this is not the same thing as a sorority or a fraternity, in my view. This is really life-changing opportunity. I think, as we all know, whether you're looking at today's news about the WNBA, but women's sports have become big business, big avenues for success, endorsements, etc. But it's not just financial, it's simply individual flourishing, if you want to use that word. This is in the news. What's going on? What's the status of this? And then when we get that background from you, does there appear to be some sort of backlash against what has been prevailing lately?
Yeah. So the Title IX regulation by its text says that it doesn't address athletics. So there was a narrative, I think, in the media afterward that women could still have women's sports, that this regulation wasn't touching women's sports. But that is a lie. The Biden administration doesn't think that the regulation needs to address women's sports because they think that Title IX, the law itself, already eliminates them. In other words, you can have women's sports, that it's perfectly fine to have women's sports, except that your women's sports have to include men. And so that's not women's sports. So that's the position, that's the the current position of the Biden administration, that it is, you know, it's allowable to have women's sports, but it has to be gender identity inclusive in order to comply with Title IX. And yeah, this is harmful. So we've seen a lot of examples on why this is harmful. So the obvious one is just unfair competition. And this is, you know, Riley Gaines will talk about it, and a lot of other people had to swim against Leah Thomas, which is, here out of nowhere, the 300 to 700th ranked male who swam for 3 years on the UPenn male team all of a sudden gets to go on the UPenn female team. And all of a sudden, Penn is competing in the NCAA championships. How's that happening? Oh, because it's a man. And mm-hmm. And then there's also like the dignity harm. So the women who are on the UPenn team, they were forced to change and just be fully naked. It takes a long time apparently to get into these competition swimsuits with a biological male right there. And these are sexual assault victims, some of them. And not only that, when they asked their administrators what can be done about this, the administrators sent them to counseling and said that you need to like examine your bigotry and why you cannot accept Will Thomas, now Leah Thomas, as a female.
Yeah, I think this is one of the most really, I don't know, repulsive examples of failed leadership that we see. The lack of obvious, not just common sense, but courage to just say what everybody knows, which is this is a total invasion of privacy. I can't imagine any father or parent, but I'm going to say father, would want their daughter to be forced to be in a dressing room naked with men, biological men. I just don't think, and so where, I always question, of course, and we know the answer because these people are just cowards, but, you know, where is the head of the NCAA? Where are the parents? Where are the athletes? You know, where are all these women athletes, by the way, who in my era, when women's pro sports really were exploding, and these people were advocating for women this and women that, and I think you've seen it yourself, whether it's the U.S. Women's soccer team people, or you know, the tennis pros, all the people who benefited from women's sports, because obviously, if you didn't need to separate men and women in competition, it would have never happened. There's a reason why men don't compete against women in tennis. I mean, there's not going to be a lot of wins for Serena Williams playing against the best men's tennis players. This doesn't even have to be said. The same thing for every single sport. So, but it to me, it's a gross failure. I don't know if hypocrisy is a strong enough word. There's no question in here, but I just wonder, where is everybody? And how do these people even show their faces to their own wives, daughters, sisters? Where is everybody? I don't know. I that's not a question that can be answered, but I don't know what your reaction to that is. No,
I mean, the cowardice, I think, stems from the reaction on the other side is people will kill themselves, right? I mean, it's just, if you say that this man is a man, he will kill himself. So all of a sudden,
well, you don't have to force him to be a man. I mean, he just can't compete against women.
But
that's all.
Yeah, exactly. And so because you're not letting him live his true self, which is competing against the women's team, then he's not able to fully live, fully be a woman. And that is harmful. Of course, the science behind that claim is not accurate. There is no indication that social transition, medical transition, chemical transition is actually life-saving. I mean, these are claims that are not true,
right?
But they are the claims.
We've seen some false claims in science over the years. Yes, we have.
But you must follow the science. So I think there's that awareness.
Is there any move to have open division sports as the quote solution to this?
There is. So the Olympics, because they're, for example, Leah Thomas tried to file a suit to compete as a female in the Olympics, even though I don't think he's even tried to qualify. But there is an open division. So there's a lot of problems with his standing, which is that he's not trying to compete as a woman. He's not part of the conversation right now. But even if he wanted to compete as his true authentic self, there is an open category. So yes, you know, the problem is resources, I think people would say. We can't have men's, women's, and open. But if you're talking about resources,
You could if there was a demand.
And it's heavy resource intensive, actually, to include men in women's sports, because a lot of women are going to be very uncomfortable. So all of a sudden you're retrofitting all these locker rooms. Like this is resource intensive regardless.
Right. Let me move on to finish with something, a big picture issue. And that is the idea that there's two sort of things that are overlapping to me about the Department of Justice in general and our legal system. That one is the politicization that seems very frightening if it's actually true, and it seems to be happening. Like third world countries weaponize their system against political opponents, but something more specific, and that is the infiltration of social advocacy into the judicial system and maybe the bench itself. And I say that knowing that, of course, social change is a good thing and has been done. That's what equal rights were all about when they didn't exist. That's what anti-discrimination laws, that you could say that was social advocacy, and that was reasonable. But it seems like there's sort of a perversion of what's going on here, where there's this almost a denial of reality, a denial of basic biology, a non-fact-based discussion about things that are supposed to be based on evidence. I just sort of wanted to throw that out and see what you thought.
Yeah, so there's always been a debate about whether the Constitution should be read through an originalist lens or whether it kind of grows with the times. And I think good faith people can have that debate. But as we've seen with one of Biden's judicial picks, this is a current magistrate judge trying to be a federal district judge in the Southern District of New York, which is a very powerful position. She recently said that the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, means that men have a right to enter women's prisons if they can, you know, assert that it would ease their sort of gender ideology. So here there was a male who had raped two individuals and then also had a lot of child pornography, and this is throughout the years. So somebody who has some sexual misconduct problems, like, is a rapist. And
a male person raping females.
Yes, yes. Raped actually a male and a female, but it was a boy. Okay. So pedophilic and raped a female. And tough childhood, undoubtedly. Like, this person has not, life has not been good to this person. But wants access to the women's prison. Well, you know what? There are some states that allow that. California, for example, your state, allows men to enter women's prisons. It has not been a good experiment for California. There have been pregnancies. There have been rapes. There's almost like a sort of gang situation where the various men have their like harems of women. It is not it's not good in California, but a state can do that, I guess, if they want to, maybe. But what this judge said, magistrate judge, potential federal district judge, is that the Eighth Amendment requires that males have access to women's prisons if they medically need it. And of course, that has no basis in the Eighth Amendment. So now we're no longer talking about, oh, should we do an originalist lens or does it grow? We're just making stuff up. And I think that is so, so dangerous, because once judges are unhinged, they're not attached to the law, they're not even attached to public sentiment, like what the public agrees with. The public does not agree with that. They're attached to nothing but their own progressive ideology. There's no check on that. None. Because you could pass a law to say, don't do that, and they're not checked by it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very frightening, and I think that's probably, I hate to be negative as we finish, but it seems to me like that's the downfall of free societies when you cannot even rely on the system of justice. I just don't know what is the final nail in the coffin, if that really is where we are, other than that. I'm not going to say we are there yet. I don't think we are, but we need to wake up, we as Americans, as voters, as citizens, and figure out what's important to us, because I have children, you have a couple of babies. We don't want to leave the country to our kids in the state that we're seeing it go toward. I'll finish by thanking you for being a leader. It's fantastic to see how young people like yourself are actually stepping up and becoming the leaders in your field. I think I can say that you're really one of the leaders in the legal battles over women's privacy, but also simply the existence of women. It really does boil down to that. We cannot lose that, just like we cannot lose the existence, as Riley Gaines often has said, of strong men. We need both in a healthy society. So thank you, May, for doing everything you're doing. And I hope to follow up with you and celebrate some of your victories. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, May Mailman, watch her expert legal commentary in the news and in the media. Don't forget to subscribe to this show on YouTube, as well as Spotify, Apple, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts right now. And I'll see you next time.